Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome to HR and on Tour. My name is Kat Johnson, and this is our very first interview we're recording from Charleston. We just got in today, and in a few days, we're going to be doing full afternoons of interviews with folks that are here for the festival. But to kick things off, I had to get two guys together who have been gracious with their time in talking to us about some very important foods of the Lowcountry, both historically and how they're going to impact, I think, the future of foodways in this area. So first up, we have Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills. Welcome, Glenn.
Hello. Hi.
And we have Brian Ward of Clemson University's Coastal Research and Education Center. Welcome, Brian.
Hello. How are you doing?
And I'm also joined by one of HRN's amazing hosts, Harry Rosenblum of Feast Your Ears. Thanks for joining us, Harry.
Glad to be here. It's wet in Charleston.
Yes, it is. Usually we land and it's like sunshiny and beautiful and it's like kind of a reprieve for the New Yorkers among us, but it was rainy today. So there's nowhere to go but up from here. It's going to be nice this weekend, I think.
We brought this weather directly from Brooklyn just for you.
One second. Okay, so let's kick things off by... Brian, I want to hear a little bit more about your background specifically, and you work with Clemson University, which for those who know is actually upstate in South Carolina, but you're based here in Charleston. So talk a bit about how you work with the university and why exactly you work here in the Lowcountry.
Okay, well, first and foremost, I actually grew up here in the Lowcountry, and But Clemson University is located in Clemson, South Carolina, so in the upstate. And we have research stations located throughout the state that focus on different things. And our station primarily focuses on vegetable crops. However, we have an organic portion to our farm. And in organics, you have to basically think holistically. And so we have to rotate in grains, legumes, rice, other things to that effect to make it holistic. And so that places me in a position after being here for 25 years, now I'm an assistant professor, and that gives me the ability to actually work with rice as well as all my other crops that I've been working with Glenn and Anson Mills for the past 15 years or so.
So Glenn, we've talked to you several times on the network, and so we know a bit about the backstory of Anson Mills, but give us kind of the 1 minute elevator pitch of how you got started working with rice and how that led to you building Anson Mills.
Well, my mom is Geechee, which means rice everywhere. And today it's called the Gullah Geechee Corridor, but it all has to do with the Sea Islands. And my mother was raised in Aiken, South Carolina, and on Edisto Island and in Savannah. So that's kind of like the Holy Trilogy. Everything in that triangle is rice. I mean, everything. It's all based on rice, all the culture from beginning to end, first settlement on. Having said that, I grew up with rice. I was the chef for our pets. My mother did not let me cook for the family, although I have a massive hospitality career behind me, 35 years in the hotel and restaurant business designing things and working with the best chefs in this country. I just got to the point where I wanted to grow rice instead of just experience rice at the table. I have no idea why still, but one of the first people I ran across in that endeavor was Merle Shepherd, who introduced me to Brian. Dr. Merle Shepherd was at that time director and professor emeritus at Clemson University and director of Clemson Coastal Research and Education Center here in Charleston. And he was a rice guy. They were growing rice, and Brian was growing it with him. I didn't know Brian, but they had rice here. And this is the rice kingdom. It's 480 some miles long, and it's all rice, but you can't see any rice when you drive down that road that goes 480 miles. So that's where it started, and today Brian's been phenomenal in pivot points for research for the National Rice Research Center, for the National Rice Institute in the Philippines. We're all kind of in the orbit. I'm the only tractor donkey of the crew. Everybody else is a scientist. Thank you, Brian.
Brian's making a face when you said that. I think that's maybe not the right descriptor.
Yeah, I do.
Well, I like that, though. I'm thinking of titling my book that. My agent's threatening to kill me.
But, yeah. I do my fair amount of donkey tractor driving as well.
It's an important role.
Brian's the real deal. He actually does it.
Yeah.
That's true. He's a horticulturist.
So how far back does the Coastal Research and Education Center go? How long has it been here? And kind of how has the work evolved over those years?
Well, the land itself was actually a plantation dating back to the 1700s. But it actually came into Clemson's possession in the 1930s. And the facility, the lab itself, was built in 1932. And then the USDA joined up with Clemson, and then they built their research facility in 1936. And then in 2003, we built a massive brand new facility across the street on the USDA property. So, and we've been growing rice now since 1988, I think it is.
Wow. What was kind of the impetus of bringing rice into the center?
That was Merle Shepherd. He was the director of the International Rice Institute in the Philippines for 2 years. And then when he came back, he got a job with Clemson, and he basically wanted to continue his work from the Philippines. And that's where it started.
Mm. So then talk a bit more about how the two of you first started to work together and what that looked like.
Well, essentially, it was a really good pro bono type of work. I needed grain and I needed rice for my rotations, and growers needed seed. And so Glenn, through the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation and Anson Mills, would provide small amounts of seed for me. I would use those in my rotations. I would increase the seed. And then that seed would go to growers outside of South Carolina, and then they would actually grow a crop, and it basically makes a full circle, you know. So that's essentially how our relationship began. And then I started to get into heavy, and then I landed a federal grant working with rice, and so that took it to the next step.
So let's talk about what's happening now. Whether is obviously a big factor when it comes to when and what you're planting. Climate change is here, and obviously rice is something that grows in the low country. How is that affecting the way you're growing rice in this region?
Well, I'll kick it off. The idea I had, and this is a long program, and we're hoping you can come back because it's going to be so cool. This fall, we're bringing 3 scientists in besides Brian, and Brian and the 3 scientists are going to present on what we're about to cover. It'll be sometime in November. We still don't have the date yet, but it'll be at Wormslow Plantation in Savannah with Sarah Ross and crew, Mashama Bailey, BJ Dennis. A whole bunch of chefs are coming to this thing, and it's going to be an exploration of the coastal agronomy in situ, because that's what Wormslow's so much into. And Sarah's phenomenal on that. She's
on
the
board. Can you talk a little bit more about what Wormslow is really?
Oh, Wormslow Plantation, I'm sorry, is just outside of Savannah. It's actually in Savannah. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the oldest rice locations on the East Coast, because the slaves that were brought there by the British at first settlement had rice, and they've done extensive seed archaeology on a very high peer review level, looking at the remnants of those gardens of rice there. And so that kicked off Sarah's interest, and being Sarah, 432 cultivars later of Sea Island associated rare plants, which she gives the seed away for free. We all do, by the way, including Brian. We don't monetize seed in any of this, and it's in public domain. So it's astounding what they have accomplished there in the last half decade. And they're now doing a rice program, so we're going to celebrate that. And in celebrating that, we're looking at all facets of rice, and the scientists that are coming in are working with Brian to work on resilient systems for rice horticulture. And so the whole focus of this thing next fall is going to be, what's the cutting edge worldwide? These are the cutting edge scientists. Believe it or not, one of them was only 6 months ago at the University of Colorado. There's so much rice in Colorado. Have you noticed?
Mm-hmm. Couldn't
find any.
Well,
that's
like
a misconception, I think, is where rice can be grown in general.
Yeah, it can be grown anywhere. Yeah. Right, and it is. And that's what this is about. Mm-hmm. So my short introduction is, I didn't know, because I'm not a scientist, that Brian was already drafting into this program and getting all the starter cultivars for resilient rice systems here as trial plots, if I understand it correct. Right, doctor?
That's correct.
Okay, go for it.
Well, essentially, there's one of the major problems along the coastline now is saltwater intrusion, and growers have had to deal with salt, you know, since the dawn of time when they grew rice here. And
I'm going to interrupt since
yes.
I'm one.
Yes,
three times in 5 years, I've got a field that has the most persistent aquatic weed in the world that blew in from Africa in a hurricane while the whole bloody field salted. So this is right on point. I'm 2 years in trying to recover it right now. Go ahead.
So essentially, it's a no-brainer idea. So what what happens is growers have been dealing with this since the dawn of time in the brackish waters. But how they deal with it is basically when the tide comes in, the salt in the water table itself actually will begin to sink. Okay, at dead high tide, there's about a 20-40 minute lull. So at that point in time, they'll actually bring water in off the top, okay, where it's fresh water. Okay, and so that's how they avoid salting the fields out. Okay, however, by us tapping wells and aquifers, and basically in these hurricane events and other climatological events, we're starting to get an increase in the salt. Is actually the saltwater freshwater dividing line is actually starting to be pushed. And so where we've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres of rice fields, some of those we can't grow rice anymore because of the fact that they're salted out. So some scientists in both here in the United States and abroad have found some wild types that have actually had these things called QTLs. Basically, they're sections on the chromosome that identify for salt tolerance. And so they've identified quite a few salt tolerant varieties now. And so ultimately what we're gonna do is we've submitted a grant, okay, to the federal government for an organic transitions grant. And that grant basically is it works for organic transition and organic growers, but it also attacks, you know, the whole climate thing. If there's a bunch of facets in it. And so it was a no-brainer. So what we're going to try to do is see if we can get these rice varieties to grow here and see which varieties actually are really, you know, robust. And then at some point in time, hopefully maybe try to back cross them into some existing old land race lines like Carolina Gold. And so we'll have salt tolerant Carolina Gold rice and some of our other, like Jefferson's Scarlet and some of our other unique heirloom type land race lines. And then we'll have a more robust rice production in the low country of South Carolina. And also there's another unique thing is that we're actually trying to work with growers to grow these lines, okay, on this salt infringed properties, and then cut maybe 70% and then leave 30% for the early migrating birds and waterfowl, and then the ratoon crop that comes back from the 70% that was cut will be for the later migrating birds. So it benefits growers, it benefits the wildlife, and it benefits basically the economy as a whole. So it's a win-win-win situation.
I'm so interested that you bring up the migratory birds because my dad works on a wildlife refuge in Alabama, and they're starting to see a drop in the birds that are coming, that are passing through. And they used to work with cooperative farmers to plant corn, flood that. That was what the birds wanted to eat. Are you seeing a similar thing happening around here? And is that something that you have been working? Is that a project of yours that you work on a consistent basis?
It's not a consistent thing, but one of the reasons why I wanted to work where I work now in agriculture is because of waterfowl. Okay, and so that got me into the whole research. Okay, so I went to Auburn as my undergrad.
War Eagle,
and but I wanted to save the world.
Yeah.
And so, and then I didn't realize until actually I had a job, you know, as a summer grunt, you know, digging water furrows and ditches, making no money at all. How much the research that we do out there actually is for the benefit of the environment. It's everything we do out there is for the reduction of petrochemical use, and precision ag. And so it basically, all of it basically was caused by my interest in wildlife and waterfowl and migratory birds. And I have seen a dramatic drop in the migratory birds along the coast here in South Carolina. Dramatic. And you can ask any waterfowl person in the state and they'll tell you the same thing.
So in planting the rice the way that you're envisioning it, do you anticipate that will hopefully bring back some of these migratory birds?
Actually, I'm pretty positive it will. Yeah. And so one of the things is birds, migratory birds are easily imprinted. Mm-hmm. And so when they imprint no food, okay, their offspring and so on and so forth will not want to come in that flyway. But when you offer food, okay, then it becomes imprinted upon them, and then the numbers will increase over time.
Well, I didn't expect to talk about migratory birds.
I know.
That's awesome, though.
It's all interlinked.
It's a big circle. Yeah. You know, it's a big circle.
We haven't said it yet, but it's called global sea level rise, and it's also talking about the fact when you think about coastal ag that up until 3 years ago, and my favorite rice scientist in the whole world is Dr. Anna McClung at the National Rice Research Center, who told me now 7 years ago that I was crazy. I should have been moving north then. I didn't do it. So it's been a mad dash. We're 750 miles north of our southernmost fields now. We didn't stop farming in the areas because we don't want to extract and not give people income. Mm-hmm. But we moved up into Missouri, and Carolina Gold wouldn't have matured in Missouri even 60 months ago.
Wow.
You know, and it's best crop we've ever had the last 2 years. And we're going for a third and moving north in Missouri now, too.
As you're moving and trying to find newer places to grow rice, what is that process like? How are you finding more land?
Well, we don't. We actually go beg farmers who are in situ. And in the case of Missouri, there was no one growing Carolina gold. And so that's like going to Egypt and you don't speak the local language. Literally, I'm not kidding. Wonderful, smart, you know, half the rice in America is grown in that region, right? So it's not like they don't know what they're doing. So it's a boon in one way, because as soon as they understood what we were talking about, they were all over it. And horticulture is right on the pin over there. That doesn't help South Carolina, except for biosecurity. And so we have seed and production there, and it's moving forward. So coming back to the challenge, the breadbasket of rice, I mean, Anna McClung was in the New York Times in May being quoted by Kim Severson, said, you know, half the rice in America is not sustainable. And I didn't know Brian was working on this. This is really, really cool. This point work, they talk about it all over the world, but the places where it's actually being done, relatively small right now, but it's going to accelerate massively. They moved a rice scientist to the University of Massachusetts at Boston in order to deal with this. It's a consortium of MIT, Yale, UMass Boston, and Dr. Brooke Moyer, who's a genius, and she's quite young. You see, it's a lot of women in this. It's a good thing, right? The other is Sayopala, who's a horticulturist and a researcher from Texas A&M in rice studies, who's up there in the cranberry bogs. knocking around looking at converting all the cranberry bogs to rice security for biosecurity for feeding people rice. My friends in the business are already staggering around looking for seed. This comes back to the thing, it's not just rice production, it's not just waterfowl. What about our biosecurity? This becomes a national challenge, and it is. And Brian's taking it that way, and this is in consortium with Anna McClung and the team at NRRC, correct?
That's correct.
Go for it. That's really cool.
Essentially,
program.
So I contacted Anna McClung and I mentioned, and actually, I mean, I'd be, you know, remorse to say that my team up on Clemson, I have some team members up on Clemson that actually we came up with the idea, you know, about salt tolerance and rice and SRI, which is System of Rice Intensification. So we're going to actually be utilizing modified version of that where you basically spread the plants out. But after I spoke with them, we had a conference, a meeting, and then I went to Anna McClung and I asked Anna McClung, so what do you tell me about salt tolerant rice? And she sent me a paper and forwarded the information to one of her colleagues there at Dale Bumpers in Arkansas. And they listed 11 different varieties here in the States that have already been identified out of, I think, close to 300 lines that were looked at. And actually one does actually have a Carolina in its name. But I can't remember the exact name of it right now, right offhand. But this is hopefully the grant gets funded. Even if the grant doesn't get funded, we'll work around that to try to find funding, you know, to keep this effort up. And if we'll just reapply next year if it doesn't get funded this year, you know, and we'll generate some baseline data this year regardless, and do some seed increase.
That's what's really cool about Brian. He's doing it. He's going to do it.
Yeah. So
that's really cool.
Yeah. So that's the bottom line. The model, the whole model with growers working on land that's, you know, marginal at best, being able to make money, you know, being able to produce a product for local chefs, and then benefiting the habitat. I mean, it's just a win-win-win. And so the model is foundational. And once you have a foundational model that's already been proven, actually, it's already been proven on federal lands. And we're trying to work with state lands now, because they have a lot of impoundments that.
What's it? Do you remember the acreage figures? It's staggering.
Well, I mean, so I spoke with Dr. Hayden Smith at the College of Charleston. He's a historian, and the numbers range once as high as 500,000 acres of flooded land in South Carolina. Well, from essentially Wilmington to Savannah, and so, but in at any given time, I think the max in production at one time was around 220,000 acres. And then it declined sharply, you know, around 1900, you know, so the potential, for us to make something great again is there. And so, and although, you know, hurricanes are probably one of the biggest issues, and just like Carolina Gold, we working with, you know, the scientist and 13 mothers as far as the lines that were bred to make Charleston Gold. Okay, we now have something that's that can withstand hurricanes. Okay, because it's shorter, it's more robust, and so that's the same similar type of thing. You look at one thing first, cultural practices, and then you try to use some breeding. And then we'll hopefully get some of these genetics, you know, classical breeding into some of these older lines. And so hopefully we'll have we'll prove our model, you know, on paper, you know, in peer reviewed journals, and then move forward from that and then start breeding. Okay. And so then we can have our traditional flavors come through, you know, that basically is the reason for the most part why you're here today, you know, in Charleston. I mean, it's because of Carolina Gold rice.
Deliciousness.
Yes. So, and there's a, it all, in a way, you hear about global sea level rise, catastrophe, collapse of this, that, biosecurity, and it tends to be kind of, oh my God, hairs on fire running out the door kind of thing. But it helps to know your history, where my buddy David Shields, Dr. David Shields, who's chairman of our foundation, comes in. who did a project with me for Orton Plantation up in North Carolina. It's 12,500 acres all day with a 7.8-mile watershed behind it, freshwater, and it's terraced coming back down around into the Wilmington River. And their biosecure routines there were well documented. It's the Moore family owns it, and it dates back to 1720-something, I believe, 1726. McDonald clan, just if anyone's out there thinking about that. Way over my pay grade. I don't know what my lineage is. I'm afraid to find out. I think it might have something to do with
you
another
taken
planet.
The DNA test yet?
No. But anyhow, David plumbed the records, and some things we know for a fact that are easy to understand that you could tell school children, which I love because that's my level, is guess where your collards came from. Your collards came from Europe because we needed to desalt our rice fields. How many people know that? And why don't we teach that in school? Coleworts came here because they're salt tolerant. They'll trap salt, then you graze them off, and the salt goes into animals and or people, and everybody's happy. It could be people or animals grazing. Benny is salt tolerant. That's African sesame. And if you start looking at the Carolina Rice Kitchen and you look at the core plants that are in there, both from Africa and from Europe and from the Far East, they're all salt tolerant, drought tolerant, blah, 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 all climate change specialists. And the definition of rice pea, which is the unguiculatas or cow peas or field peas, whatever you want to call it, they're all beans, but that class particularly that fits this agronomic that Brian studies, and he did this for me, thank you. He put Petit Rouge Huguenot peas in for a salt and flood tolerance, and we all thought they weren't going to be flood tolerant. He was growing them underwater, and then so he saw them dying, so he pulled the water off, went back and flooded them again like 3 or 4 days later, and at the 10-day point, they could just mature out underwater. Flood tolerant. So global sea level rise, not only are they salt tolerant, they're flood tolerant, and they're drought tolerant. If you have those three, you're talking about Sea Island and Coastal Carolina Rice Kingdom plants. And in order to make that fun, you look at the core foods of the Carolina Rice Kitchen, and what is it? Reezy peasy, which is rice peas and gravy over rice with collards. That is the system. If you put some barley biscuits with it, the oldest barley was introduced here because it's salt tolerant, drought tolerant, water tolerant. Bear barley. Bear is the determinant of beer. It's astounding. So we get beer, whiskey, and everything else. We became a whiskey capital here and because of grapes and a brandy capital. Yummy.
So it's not always about trying to necessarily breed a new plant or breed something new, but it's about re-educating people on what can actually grow
horticulturally. Yeah,
that we already have.
Yes,
it's already there.
And taking the traits from those, the genetic building blocks, is taking the traits from those broad land races, bringing them in to current production, which like Row 7 from Dan Barber's and Charlotte Douglas, my favorite smart person in the whole world. Their effort, Kate Barney. A good Southern girl in that Yankee team, excuse me. That's allied with their efforts too. How do you take the best of the genetics, don't mess them up, like Brian's been working with for decades, and take them into something that works in the modern world?
So what does the future of this look like? So you said that, historically we're talking about 200,000 acres that were under cultivation that had a sort of heavy decline. How many of those acres are under cultivation now? And then let's say we sit down again in 10 years, what are we looking at numbers wise?
We did a survey you have to go from Florida. So you're essentially Cooper Island, Fernandina Beach, it's kind of the same area. So if you're familiar with the coastal geographies of Georgia, Carolina, North Carolina. So if you take that span of miles in, the acreages are well over 2,000 now, but it's all spread out. There's no grand rice plantation. The largest rice plantation in the history of American agriculture is Delta, and the two fields down there are bifurcated by what used to be the carriage path, and it looks like Africa. I mean, it's 1,600 acre fields a piece, and they have much more land than that too. But that was just decorative. Two 1,600 acre fields decorative so that they could just witness rice growing. Of course, they had a ton of slaves doing it. There's a horrific side too. But the culture is astounding when you look at it on a biosecure basis and look at it as resilience and look at it as a farming system that worked then. And we keep thinking, well, we've learned so much since then. And then you reach back and you see those genetics at work and you go, oh, wait a second. They already did that. Let's grab that history and bring it forward. And that's what's going on now. There's not as much crisping as one might think in this. I went to a Yale conference, and I expected to hear about the cutting edge of crisping new plants for resilience.
You're talking about like CRISPR?
There's not so much of that. There's a lot of, let's dig into the land races and pull them up fast and use those characteristics. We can prove, we've got the histories of them out there. We're not experimenting anymore. We're actually looking at trials that have a history.
Sure.
So that's a good thing.
Right.
So 2,000 acres is probably good. And nationally, Anna said it's a lot more than that. There's a lot of Carolina gold, our Carolina gold, which belongs to the Rice Kingdom. It's all over the place now. It's even in California.
I mean, it seems like we've come to a point where we're looking backwards at the reasons these plants were grown here originally, and we went through such a crazy industrialization in the 18th and 19th century that allowed for large, big ag, right? And now we're coming to a point where we actually need the old technology.
Yeah, Brian is my tutor on this. He's the one that taught me about phenotypic plasticity. He told me there'd be a test later, too. Phenotypic plasticity means that there's enough genetic depth in whatever plant you're dealing with. If you move it, it adapts. That's phenotypic plasticity. I always thought it was just, I'll move it, it'll adapt.
It's like plastic. So it's like actually the title of the grant, actually in the title of the grant is reintroduction of rices in pre-Green Revolution environments. Through the use of salt tolerance and system of modified rice intensification, so something to that effect. I'm not sure exactly right offhand, but hopefully we'll move forward one way or the other. We're going to move forward.
When will you find out about the grant?
I think we'll probably find out sometime in July, okay. August. So it won't be. Although we're going to acquire the lines from the germplasm, facility in Arkansas, and so we'll acquire the lines this year and do a seed increase this year with them, and just basically do a complete like phenotypic expression, how they grow, just all the different variables, looking at, days to maturity, days to flowering, days to pre-boot, days to boot, tiller counts, disease occurrence, all these different things. There's a lot more that's in the grant that we're going to do, but we'll do that baseline data this year. So when we go in next year, we won't be going in blind. We'll already know what the plants are going to be doing. So we'll have a good idea. And a lot of research is like that, where you'll do baseline data, collection prior to the actually doing the full-fledged work, and so that way you make the research more ergonomic down the road.
And what we've done at the foundation in the past is we don't wait for grant monies. Sometimes we jump in and we'll run a parallel that gives the scientist absolutely no obligations for results and or otherwise just turn them loose, because the entire board of the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation comes from that scientific ethos. These are our advisors, Gurdjieff Kush through World Food Prizes, one of the best rice minds in the history of the world, period. And I can call him and ask him a question. It's just amazing, and he'll answer the phone.
Glenn, right? I think there's a lot of people that will answer the phone when you call.
You'd be surprised. not him.
Well, to keep us posted about the grant, because I really want to know how all this continues onward.
Me too.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you both so much for sitting down with Harry and me and talking to us about rice and the things you're working on. It's really nice to be down in Charleston once a year to catch up on the work you're doing.
Cool.
And sometimes we see Glenn other places too.
Yeah. Like we almost were on the same plane today.
We'll see you in Charlotte for the Bread Symposium.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Probably. I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm going
to
be there.
Yeah. We'll have to come back to Charleston more often.
Yes, that's right. I don't get out too often.
We'll have to come to the research center.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be actually fantastic. Actually, if y'all can make a special trip.
Yes.
Maybe this summer, you know, great. say late July, August, you know, we should be in flower hopefully by then.
Ooh.
You know, and
we could come down and see it growing right after the Brett Symposium.
That'd be awesome.
That'd work.
That's perfect. Know?
And we could actually, I could actually have a small field day.
Yeah.
And bring some growers from the local sea islands.
And I could get some of those rices, maybe enough for Harry P. Mueller at the Bread Symposium to make some rice bread.
We'll have to pitch a
Are
workshop.
You ready for that?
Let's do it.
Ready for that? That was amazing. The number one bread during our colonial era. No one seems to remember. Yeah. It was always rice bread. It wasn't just wheat bread.
And then I finally want to make it down to Sapelo Island. Still on my list.
You're going
to
do that?
Haven't done it yet.
We can all do it.
Yeah. I was down in Brunswick with Matthew Rayford and Javon Sage in December and so close and still haven't made it. So next time.
Doc, Bill, and Anita.
Yeah.
They're ready.
Have to stay in the birdhouses.
That's what I want to do. I want to see
those
bulls.
It's the best place on the East Coast. People don't know that.
Yeah.
It is.
It's best beautiful. Kept secret. Absolutely beautiful. You
know, fighting bulls, fighting cows.
Well, we have a lot more plans now lined up, so I feel good about ending this interview. Thank you again. Once again, I'm Kat Johnson with Harry Rosenblum, Brian Ward, and Glenn Roberts.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you very much.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.